Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to Giles Brandreth, broadcaster, writer, former MP, but most importantly, chairman of the judges of Oldie of the Year and a very distinguished Oldie columnist. And now he has written an absolutely terrific, very moving book, Somewhere, A Boy and a Bear, a biography of A.A. Milne and Winnie the Pooh. And we're just coming up to the 100th birthday of Winnie the Pooh. Can you tell us how he was born, as it were?
Christmas Eve, 1925, a story appeared in the first Winnie the Pooh story appeared in the London Evening News. And A. Milne was already famous. He was famous as a playwright, principally. He wrote 40 plays and screenplays. There was one point, I think in 1922, when he had 7 plays running in the West End of London simultaneously. He was the Alan Ayckbourne of his day. Plays in London and New York, hugely popular as a playwright. Before that, he was best known as a columnist in the magazine Punch. As I often say, the Oldie is the Punch of our day. Punch, young people don't realise this, Punch almost was the British Empire. It was a humorous magazine that appeared once a week, and there was not a club or a dentist's waiting room that didn't have a copy, but people had it at home. And he, A.A. Milne, wrote columns in this. He was the Craig Brown, Alan Corrin of his day, as well known as that. But he liked doing different things. And after he'd been a columnist for 20 years, he began writing novels, then plays. He wrote a murder mystery, all this before Winnie the Pooh. He wrote a murder mystery called The Red House Mystery, which has never been out of print, published a year before The Mysterious Affair at Styles, the famous first Agatha Christie Hercule Poirot appearance, acclaimed by many as one of the founding books of the golden age of British detective stories. And then in 1920, he had a son. He and his wife, Daphne. He'd met Daphne because of Punch, because the editor of Punch was her godfather. And I think he was taken to her coming out dance. And they met just before the First World War. I think she was about 21 and he was coming up for 30. But they got on famously right from the beginning godfather was the editor of Punch. She knew the magazine well, and she already knew who A.A. Milne was. In fact, she had some of his lines by heart. Now, as a writer, you will appreciate that this is a good way to a man's heart.
Yes.
If you meet someone and they say, oh, I love your pieces, and then quote from them, you know it's for real. And if ever you asked A.A. Milne what it was, why he loved Daphne, why they'd got married, he would say quite simply in 5 words, she laughed at my jokes. Ladies, if you're listening, that's all that it takes. She laughed at my jokes. So they were married, and they had their first and only child in August 1920. A year later, Christopher Robin, that was the name of the child, was given a teddy bear for his birthday, and the teddy bear became Winnie the Pooh. And at home in London, and they got a country house in the mid-1920s, Christopher Robin, who I was lucky enough to know, the real Christopher Robin, when he grew up, I knew him when he was in his 60s, he told me that he and Winnie the Pooh were inseparable. And he had other animals too, all bought from Harrods. There was Kanga and Roo and Piglet. No Tigger. Tigger was the one creature, invented by A.A. Milne. But as it happens, when you have children, you don't have children, do you?
No.
But when you have children, you'll find, if you're a writer, you write for them. So when I had children, I began writing children's books. And A.A. Milne, who liked to do new things, wrote a collection of children's verses called When We Were... couldn't decide what to call it, When We Were Very Young. And it contains all the poems that we know, Little Boy Kneels at the Foot of the Bed, A Changing Guard, A Buckingham Palace, you name it, they're all in there. James, Morrison, anyway, I won't go on. But it's interesting, they're all still in the rattle bag of our minds. He wrote these poems. They were published a bit reluctantly by his publishers in London and America, because they thought, let's have another detective story. Your detective story went so well, but he liked to do new things, so he did this. And I think this book was published on the same day as The Great Gatsby, by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which didn't do badly. I think sold about 20,000 copies in the first year. Whereas When We Were Very Young sold 200,000 copies before Christmas.
Amazing.
And remains, after the poems of William Shakespeare, the best-selling anthology of poetry in the history of mankind.
Incredible.
So, they wanted more children's poems from him, the publishers, and he didn't want any more of those. But with his son, Christopher Robin, and Daphne, his wife, they played with these toys. Daphne came up with amusing voices for the toys. And, well, A.A. Milne being a good writer, he wrote these stories. And the stories took off. And, of course, Winnie the Pooh is one of the most successful books, children's books, ever. And it indeed made A.A. Milne rich and famous. He was already quite rich and already quite famous, but it made him really rich and famous. Sadly, it did not make him happy. And Christopher Robin, the little boy in the books, the real little boy, well, at first it made him, he was quite excited to be Christopher Robin in these hugely successful storybooks. A survey was done in the late 1920s of who were the most famous real children in the world. And top of the survey came two people, a boy and a girl. The most famous girl in the world in the late 1920s was Princess Elizabeth, who went on to be Elizabeth II, and the most famous boy was Christopher Robin Milne. And he quite liked all that. He liked signing autographs. He was happy to have his photograph taken, give interviews occasionally. He even made a record singing Little Boy Kneels at the Foot of the Bed, a poem called Vespers. But that poem came to haunt him, because when he was sent away to boarding school and he was a little bit older, the boys, well, Christopher Robin, you the little boy kneels at the foot of the bed. And they began singing the song to him. And in fact, they had a record. I think it was there were various recordings. One of the most successful was by Vera Lynn. And Christopher Robin, the real Christopher, told me he found the record in the common room at Stowe, where he was at school, and he took it out into a field, broke it into 100 pieces and threw it away. Joined the army. Again, you're Christopher Robin. Left the army after the Second World War.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Giles. At this stage, he was still close to his father, I think, for the first 20 years.
Yes, you're right. You're right to interrupt me there, because this is key to it. He would say later that he wasn't very close to either of his parents when he was very small, that really they didn't know him and he didn't know them, because it was a traditional middle-class, upper-middle-class household where the nanny really did the caring. And the parents, though they did indeed tell the stories, read the stories, play with the bears, play with the toys, they were, in his view, quite distant. I think he said, if I can't say I didn't love my mother, I didn't love her, but that's because I didn't know her. That would be his line then. But he got to know his father in the 1930s when he was in his teens. And you're right, they were very close until he was about 20. They were very close for two reasons. One is that they had things in common. They loved mathematics, they loved doing crossword puzzles, they loved nature together. And according to Christopher, his father was a bit buttoned up with small children, but much more relaxed with him when he was a teenager. But there was another reason. A.A. Milne himself had had an idyllic childhood, in his own view. And it came from a family, a happy family, loved his parents. But he had two brothers called Barry and Ken. Barry, he didn't like. Barry, he mistrusted. And if you look at the pictures in my book, and you see a picture of these three boys, you'll be able to tell at once which one is the one he didn't trust. Which is a bit harsh, just looking at the picture of a child, but that's the way it is. He never trusted Barry, but he loved his other older brother, who was called Ken. They were boon companions. You could say Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh are Ken and Alan, or Piglet and Pooh are Alan and Ken. They were bosom buddies. They were boon companions. They just had a happy childhood together. And they were best friends all their lives, but tragically, in the 1920s, Ken died early of pneumonia. And happiness then... Well, I don't think A.A. Milne was ever happy.
But you described him very well, almost as a sort of loner, and it's actually quite hard to grasp his character, is that right?
He's an elusive figure. One of his, I mean, what the book is largely about is the enchanted places of our childhood. Funny enough, I begin my journey writing this book in Jamaica, because A.A. Milne's father was born in Jamaica from missionary parents. And I went to Clarendon in Jamaica, where A.A. Milne's father was born. It is an enchanted place. It's like a forest, you know, the wonderful butterflies and birds and amazing plants and flowers. You do feel you're in a kind of magic world. And A.A. Milne felt his own childhood, because his father came back to England, became a teacher and his own school. A.A. Milne, being brought up in late Victorian England, felt that late Victorian London was a kind of child's playground. He could roam freely. He went to the museums, went to the zoo. He played in the streets of London on his bicycle with his brother. They were very, very happy. But it all began, well, growing up for him began at the age of 12. There's a very touching bit in the book, and if you remember this, where A.A. Milne is saying goodbye to his father, farewell, papa. And this was at the age of 12, and he began the long process of saying goodbye. And A.A. Milne was happy with Ken and easy with Ken, and he was happy with Daphne, who laughed at his jokes, his wife in the early days. But otherwise, he was quite a closed person. Christopher Robin said he was very buttoned up. I think one of the reasons he left his money, his money is relevant because the money he left was huge and became even huger when Disney got involved in, you know, Winnie the Pooh and acquiring Winnie the Pooh. But he left his money four ways when he died in 1956, a quarter to his family, a quarter to Westminster School, which always surprised me because he didn't, well, he quite liked Westminster School, but he hated the food, so maybe he left the money to, you know, enhance the cooking. A quarter to the Royal Literary Fund, because he actually was a serious writer and wanted to support writers, and a quarter to the Garrick Club. And the Garrick Club was one of his enchanted places. He felt safe in the Garrick Club, but a chap could not give, or didn't have to give too much away from himself, of himself, could be at ease with other chaps, saying whatever he wanted to say, but being left as a private individual. And what is interesting is he was quite a private person. He enjoyed the company of two or three people over dinner, didn't very much like crowds. And yet, if you read his novels, and he wrote six novels, which I have read and reread, they're so good. One of them called Two People. P.G. Woodhouse said I could reread this novel every year, twice. I mean, he writes beautifully. He also has an unerring instinct for the secrets of the human heart. He seems to understand women very well. And so he observes life. He's a looker at life. He doesn't necessarily engage in close relationships. People wanted to feel, for example, that he was a great friend of E.H. Shepherd, the wonderful artist who illustrated the Winnie the Pooh books, and felt they must be boon companions. And indeed, in one of the films about the story, they're made to be best friends. They weren't. He respected him, admired him as an artist, very much gave him a share of the royalties. But they weren't close. He didn't have many close friends, really, other than his brother. So his brother dies at the end of the 20s. That's when Christopher Robin becomes a teenager and comes into his own. So almost becomes the substitute for his brother. And they get on well. But then the Second World War comes and Christopher Robin goes into the army. There's more slight joshing about being Christopher Robin. And then emerges from the army and from Cambridge, wanting to be a writer himself and suddenly feeling lost. I want to be a writer, but my dad is one of the most famous writers in the world, hugely successful. And what am I? I'm Christopher Robin. And you would go for jobs, all kinds of jobs. And they would say, Milne, are you by any chance related to the great A.A. Milne? Oh, you're C.R. You must be Christopher Robin. Little boy kneels at the... It just drove him mad. And that's when he said he accused his father of building his reputation... A.A. Milne, building his reputation by standing on a small boy's shoulders.
That's brilliant, that quote. And then does this extraordinary thing of running a bookshop, which I think his mother says this is completely crazy, didn't she?
Totally crazy, because as the mother says, you're going to meet people coming to the bookshop every day saying, oh, I want to buy a book by A.A. Milne, aren't you Christopher Robin? Will you sign it? And in fact, in the bookshop, he did sign the books. He made you give a donation to a local charity, but he did.
In fact, I met someone in Dartmouth last week who said, I'm not Christopher Robin, but he's just upstairs. So he'd go out and then get it, sign it.
Oh, how lovely. Yes. That's a lovely story. Yes. So he wouldn't knowing he wouldn't let you know that it was him.
I'd also say, well, he's a little boy.
Way up there. Yeah, oh, that's charming. Yeah. He was a very charming...
I was going to ask what he was really like. He looked, even in the photos, he looks charming and diffident and shy.
He was charming, diffident and shy, which is why it became extraordinary to me that I got to know him. Because I'm more Tigger-like. And so... It never occurred to me to write to him and say, can I come and meet you? But because when my children were born and small in the 1980s, we read them, as I'd been read as a child, the poems and the Winnie the Pooh books, we read them to our children. And I loved them. And I thought, there's a show in this, in these verses. Could we do a side-by-side by Sondheim, but side-by-side by Winnie the Pooh or A.A. Milne? And I thought, I need some music for some of this material. Because though some music did exist, there were other poems that needed to have music. And I knew Julian Slade, the author of Salad Days. And I got in touch with Julian, and I said, I've had this idea. He said, well, by chance, I know Christopher Robin. Let's go and meet him. So we went down to Devon to meet Chris. And I wouldn't have met him if my passport, as it were, hadn't been franked by Julian Slade. Because Christopher trusted Julian, by proxy, trusted me. And I got to know Christopher and his wife, Leslie, and their daughter, Claire.
Where there is a story.
There's a story in itself. And what happened at the end of the 1940s, when Christopher Robin felt resentful that he was just the name of a child in a storybook, turned on his parents. He was lost. He was lonely. And he met his first cousin, a girl called Leslie. And fell in love with her. And the tragedy is this. I mentioned to you that A.A. Milne didn't like, in fact despised, his brother Barry. Well, by chance, A.A. Milne married a girl called Daphne, who also had a brother. And by chance, she despised her brother. And the despised brother's daughter was Leslie. And she fell in love with Christopher Robin. So in two families, you have two siblings who don't speak to one another for 30 years. And we have getting together from these two separate families, first cousins. We have Christopher and Leslie.
So they'd barely met because of this loathing.
I think probably had never met. Maybe they'd met as small children, but they met and they fell in love. And there was a wedding where both sets of parents came along but never met again. And the children, Christopher Robin... And Leslie barely saw A.A. Milne and A.A. Milne's wife ever again. After A.A. Milne's funeral, he died in 1956, which Christopher Robin's wife did not attend. She had an excuse. She was pregnant. Christopher Robin attended. He never saw his mother again.
And do you think that's because Mrs. Christopher Robin did not like her aunt? Is that
yes.
the main driver?
I think it is. Christopher... went along with all this. By the time I knew him, he was much more mellow. He'd come to understand his father and mother better. And he could, as he said to me, I can look that bear in the eye again. And he accepted it. He wouldn't accept the money. There was, we're talking about millions. I think the quarter of the income that was left to Westminster School is the largest bequest given to any school in the history of the world. We're talking hundreds of millions. And Christopher Robin wanted none of this at all. He wouldn't accept money that had been, you know, he'd so resented it. But they had a daughter, Leslie and Christopher, and the daughter was born with cerebral palsy. And Christopher said to me, it was always awkward, and people would ask, you know, because I'm Christopher Robin, do you have children? And he hummed and hawed. And he said, eventually, I thought it's easier to say, yes, we have a daughter. She's called Claire. She has cerebral palsy. She's fine. Thank you very much.
And could that be because two first cousins had married?
It could be.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily that it was, but it could have been. He, Christopher, taught me something very interesting about people with disabilities. Because I met Claire. And he said to me, view her as Claire. Please don't view her as someone who hasn't got something. She's got lots of other things. Celebrate her for what she has got. And that changed my perception of people with disabilities. reinforced, funny enough, the other year, by my friend Chris McCausland. Remember him? The blind comedian who won Strictly Come Dancing, who I know is a friend of mine. He's one of the happiest people you ever meet. And he hasn't, I mean, he can't see, but he does not, to view him through the prism of his blindness is to completely misunderstand this man. And Claire Milne was a lovely girl, woman, who loved dancing, who loved singing, who, when she was growing up, enjoyed a glass of wine, who lived her life to the full in the way that her life was. And Christopher said to me that Claire and I, we do things together. We work in wood together. And he had built toys with her. He'd built plates, some cutlery that was unbreakable, a plate that she could eat from that was unbreakable, and a spoon. And he said, my ambition in life would be to have a company called C.R. Milne and Daughter, makers of furniture for disabled young people. And he didn't take any of the money for himself or his wife, but he did take money from Disney, from Winnie the Pooh, to look after his daughter because he thought that he might predecease her, as he did. And she needed money, and she needed a home. And, of course, she has now died. And happily, though, there is now the Claire Milne Trust. And the Claire Milne Trust, to date, has given away some £12 million in grants for young people in Devon and Cornwall with various kinds of disability. So there is a honeypot at the end of the rainbow.
And Claire's mother says something very moving, that so Claire or her trust becomes very rich, and her mother says something very moving about Claire's approach to money.
Yeah. Doesn't know the difference between £10, £10,000 or £10 million. Meant nothing to her. And it meant nothing to the parents. They led happy lives. Leslie Milne didn't like her parents-in-law. I said, why? She said they weren't likeable. I don't know. Daphne, A. Milne's wife, gets a bad press. In fact, I think she was a good wife. I mean, they had their problems in the 1930s, you know. They had frustrations. He had frustrations because he felt his whole life was being dominated by Winnie the Pooh and he wanted to do other things. She had an affair in America with an American playwright. He may have had a dalliance with an English actress. Well, he did. I don't give too many details in the book, but it's all there. They went through a bad patch, but they were ultimately together and they were content to be together. So they had each other, but they lost their only child. And that was heartbreaking. And I think there might have been a reconciliation, but Leslie didn't want one. And I often think about family rifts. In my own family, three sisters and two of my sisters, no longer alive, sadly, much older than me, decade older, they didn't speak for 20, 30 years. And by the end, none of us could remember what the initial row was about. It's too ridiculous, isn't it? I don't know, in your family, is there
many?
We're
all very close, yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad for you. But it doesn't always happen. So what I wanted to do with the book, and you can perhaps answer the last question, what I want to do with the book is tell the story of a family over three generations, and in a family that functioned sometimes well, sometimes badly. The story of a writer, you know, who was hugely successful, but also to explore childhood and when we are happy, what the nature of childhood is, what the enchanted places are that meant something to him, and also tell the story of Winnie the Pooh, how he came along, how that grew and became a whole industry, all about that, because it is his centenary. But then to try and unravel the mystery of why these children's books, created 100 years ago, are still alive and still selling, still among the best-selling books, children's books in the world. Do you have an answer?
Well, I think you say, or perhaps you quote someone saying, Winnie the Pooh is pure happiness.
Yeah. It's actually A.A. Milne himself who believed that pure happiness is only there for us when we're young. I think he reckoned that it was about the age of 12 that you begin what he called the long process of saying goodbye. But when you're young, if you are blessed, as he was, with good parents, pure happiness is available to you then. It's not available later. The innocence of Eden has gone. And he was still happy, hugely happy. The early years of his marriage, he was hugely happy. You know, the success with a player, he was hugely happy. He had highs, you know. A good game of golf, he could be happy. Watching cricket, he was almost invariably happy. At the Garrick Club, he was usually happy, usually contented. But there were lows, of course. Pure happiness can only be achieved as a child. And I think what those books do that makes them different from the other books that feature enchanted places. He loved, of course, Peter Pan. J.M. Barrie was a friend and a hero. But you think of Neverland. Well, there are nasty people in Neverland. Things can go wrong. Wind in the Willows, again, it's another enchanted place, but there are weasels and stoats. There is evil there. What's different about the Hundred Acre Wood and Winnie the Pooh is it's an enchanted place where there is excitement, occasionally danger. There's a lot of comedy, but there is no tragedy, no darkness. It's a world of gratitude and honey. I mean, honestly, what more can you ask for? And I think the reason that the books have lasted is we live, oh my God, do we live in a horrible world? You know, if you watch the news or just read a newspaper, I believe some newspapers are still going. The only paper publication is The Oldie. But it's a bitter and dark world. But in the four children's books that A.A. Milne wrote, just 70,000 words in all, in those four books, you have a passport to a world of innocence that works whatever age you are. If you're a child or if you're an old person, it's so well written. But somehow, it's real. The characters, they're toys, but they're real and they're wonderful. It's a world of gratitude, of kindness, of love.
And did you manage to establish, this is impossible to do precisely, that great quote Christopher Robin says about climbing on my infant shoulders? To what extent was A. Milne looking at his son, playing with the actual toys, and literally using Christopher Robin's words and imagination? Because I think you quote a writer elsewhere who says, if you can get inside a mind of a child, you are writing the best literature possible.
Exactly. Description of genius is to get inside the mind of a child. I don't think A.A. Milne even remotely thought he was exploiting his child. He was proud of being a professional writer. He took to writing plays using J.M. Barrie as his model. He took to writing murder mysteries. Well, he couldn't take Agatha Christie as his model because she hadn't done it yet. He was one of the people who created that new genre going on from Edgar Allan Poe and Arthur Conan Doyle. He was a craftsman. So, yes, of course, he was inspired by the child. But interestingly, at home, and that's why he couldn't really understand Christopher Robin's distress at being Christopher Robin, because they didn't call him Christopher Robin at home. They called him, well, Moon, because that's the way he pronounced the name Milne. So he was known as Moon, and the father, A. Milne, was known as Blue. So they called each other Moon and Blue. So he felt, well, I've just written a storybook. This is a boy in a storybook. But of course he was Christopher Robin, and it was his teddy bear, and he was photographed, and they did. And A. Milne began to have reservations about this. And we have no idea of the scale of the, in the sense, the merchandising began in the 1920s. On this journey that I went on to write this book, one of the places I went to was the Royal Library at Windsor, because the original Vespers, the poem, Little Boy Kneels at the Foot of the Bed, was written by A.A. Milne and sent as his contribution to Queen Mary's Doll's House. So the original manuscript is in his own hand in a little book, Queen Mary's Doll's House. But when I went to see this, I then discovered, oh, they've got lots of A.A. Milne material here. And I once had a conversation with the late Queen Elizabeth II, because, as you know, I wrote a biography of her, and we were talking about Paddington Bear. I assume Paddington Bear was her great love of her life. She was born in the same year as Michael Bond, who created Paddington Bear. She said, no, Paddington Bear, no. It's Winnie the Pooh. I said, oh, really? Why, Your Majesty? And she said, well, you don't know this? I said, no, please tell me. The first book dedicated to me was The Songs and Hums of Winnie the Pooh, 1928. She was Princess Elizabeth, and A.A. Milne wrote to the palace saying, can we dedicate this book to young Princess Elizabeth, along with Christopher Robin, the most famous girl in the world. And interestingly, as a wedding present in 1947, the Archbishop of York gave, Cyril Garment gave, who gave him the sermon at the wedding, gave Princess Elizabeth, as a wedding present, she married the Duke of Edinburgh, a copy of When We Were Very Young. Unusual present to give to a royal princess who's, you know, then 21 years of age. But anyway, so she really loved it. But going along this collection, there in the Royal Library at Windsor, alongside, of course, the Shakespeare First Folios, you know, and the one annotated by King Charles on his way to the scaffold, alongside all of that is a Winnie the Pooh tea set given to the Duke and Duchess of York in 1928 when they visited a pottery factory. And there was Winnie the Pooh merchandise already in the 1920s. And though they came home with this Winnie the Pooh tea set, which clearly they favoured so much that it is still there as pride of place in the royal collection.
And that brings me on to the most remarkable merch, which is the original Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, which amazingly is now in New York. Can you tell that story, which you tell so well in the book?
Yes. Why are they in New York? Well, the long and the short of it is A.A. Milne and Christopher Robin didn't want them anymore. 1947, the American publishers of Winnie the Pooh said to A.A. Milne, "You won't come to the States. Could we have Winnie the Pooh to go on a tour?" And A.A. Milne said, "I don't mind. Of course, more means." And Christopher Robin, who was then grown up and fed up with being Christopher Robin, said, "Yes, let's get rid of them." So off they all went. Kanga, no Roo. Roo, I'm afraid, had been eaten, I think, by a dog in the Ashdown Forest in the late 1920s. But Kanga and Piglet and Tigger, they all sent off to New York. They went on this tour. They ended up in the publisher's offices. And then when the publishers were acquired by another publisher, they found their way to the New York Public Library, where they're on show now. To say they're on show now is, to put it mildly, I went as part of my journey to New York, arrived at the New York Public Library, and I couldn't believe it. On all the posters, on all the, everywhere you look, it's Winnie the Pooh. And they've got everything there. I mean, they really have got everything. They've got Shakespeare First Folios, Quartos. They've got the original Declaration of Independence. They've got George Washington's teeth. I mean, they have got a lot. They've got, interestingly enough, the walking stick that was left on the riverbank by Virginia Woolf when she took her own life. They've got Charles Dickens's writing desk. And they've also got the real Winnie the Pooh. And all the treasures, the 56 million treasures in the New York Public Library, the longest queue, the most popular item is Winnie the Pooh. There we are.
And you talk very excitingly about, forget the Elgin Marbles, that perhaps next year, 250th anniversary of the Declaration of American Independence, Giles Brandreth might bring Winnie the Pooh back to England?
I would love that. Negotiations are ongoing. The challenge for them is that it is their most valuable asset. You know, it's so precious, priceless. And also, it's their main visitor attraction. So if we take Winnie the Pooh away for them, say a month, 2 months, what are they going to put in its place? I'm pleased to say, because I'm a proud trustee of the Queen's Reading Room, Queen Camilla's charity for encouraging reading, the joy of reading, that she has said to me, well, if Winnie the Pooh comes to England, you know, the changing guard at Buckingham Palace, I'm sure Winnie the Pooh could be put up there, or maybe even Windsor Castle. So there'll be no mere Airbnb for Winnie the Pooh. They will be properly accommodated. But I'm not sure
that we could send them Magna Carta for a couple of months or something.
Well, that would be a nice idea. I don't think we're going to go as far as the crown jewels, but if we could find something that would be of interest, we hope it will happen. So watch this space. Rest assured, oldie readers will be the first to know.
And, Giles, you also, in your terrific book, talk about yourself a bit, and you, as you just have, you described yourself as a Tigger, and you say, you know, your remarkable energy and achievements you put down to pleasing your parents, even though they're sadly long dead. Mm. It is extraordinary. Is that the reason for your amazing energy?
Well, two reasons, really. I mean, I think I'm busy because at my prep school, the headmaster, Mr. Stocks, I can actually picture him where I'm standing, where he's standing, where he says this. He's to the side of his desk. And he says to me, "Brandreth, busy people, remember. Brandreth, remember, busy people are happy people." So my wife would say, "Busy fool." But that, I think, has kept me going. But what I've learnt through writing this book and through my own podcast, Rosebud, where every week I talk to remarkable people, you know, from Dame Judi Dench to Sir Keir Starmer about their first memories, it's clear to me that we are, all of us, what our childhoods made us. So what you're formed in your childhood, for good or ill, and for many people have had wonderfully happy childhoods. Others have had complicated childhoods, or there's been loss in their childhood they've had to cope with. But whatever your childhood was, that goes with you. A childhood lasts a lifetime. And I think in my case, I became conscious before I wrote this book, actually, when I was writing a childhood memoir called Odd Boy Out. I began to picture my parents and dig into material, and I realised that my parents, comfortably off, middle-class parents, absolutely, you know, my father was a solicitor, my mother was a housewife, and then later a teacher.
Wasn't there a moment they fell on hard times? I read your book.
That is the point.
Sorry.
That is the point.
Yeah.
Even when they were being successful, they were living on hard times. It was not poverty. It was middle-class spending too much. I had three older sisters. They felt they had to go to boarding school. All three of them went to Cheltenham Ladies' College. I was sent away to boarding school. I had a younger brother who went to prep school. The school fees, my mother wanted a foreign holiday every year. My father earned comfortably. He was a London solicitor. But they just spent a little bit too much. And my abiding picture, really, of my father, whenever I think of him, it's at the kitchen to my mother's in bed. John makes me think, why was my mother in bed? Why did she go to bed early? Sometimes she's in bed during the day. I now realise maybe she was depressed. I now remember that she used to take pills quite regularly. My father joked about them, the Black Bomber. I think these were antidepressants. I don't know this, but I began to think about all this. And my father would sit at the desk late into the night, and I'd be going along past the kitchen to my bedroom, you know, and I would see him sitting there with a cup of tea and a cigarette. He smoked a cigarette. He had a yellow streak in his hair because he held his cigarette up to his head. I could see this nicotine stain in his hair, and he would sit there for hours on end with all the bills laid out on the kitchen table. And he was manoeuvring one bill to next to see which one should be paid. And I'm reminded of this again because I'm on my Rosebud podcast on Tuesdays. We sometimes read from my diaries. And I've been reading from my diaries of my Oxford years, you know, 55 years ago. And my father wrote a lovely letter to congratulate me on being president of the Oxford Union, the debating society. And in my diary, I say he wrote this beautiful letter, and I quote, and then the second part of the letter was him telling me that I'd have to go and see the bursar at New College, Oxford, because my father couldn't afford to pay the fees that term, and not just the fees, because he earned enough for us not to get a grant or anything, but he also couldn't afford to pay for my lodging, and could I somehow negotiate with the bursar? And that's when I was still at university. I began earning money myself. I was writing for magazines and did a TV show when I was still at Oxford. And I began earning money, so I began paying my own fees. And then I began trying to help my parents by paying their telephone bill. I remember my father standing by the telephone when my sisters were making... He was torn about my sisters. He wanted them to have boyfriends because he wanted them to get married. Bear in mind, they're 10 years older than me. To get them off his hands. So he wanted them to be making dates and things, but he couldn't bear them going on talking. So he'd stand by the telephone, you know, doing wind-up sign hands with his hands. So I rereading this, I became conscious again of the struggle to make ends meet.
So it's a version of Dickens and the Blacking Factory,
to
some extent.
But it's a very middle-class version. And it's why when I was an MP, I was most sympathetic always to people who had money worries. There is nothing worse in the world than money worries. And you won't know this because you're younger than me, but there was a time when Michelle, my wife, and I, we were buying our first flat, and the interest rates went up something astronomical. And we were paying over the interest rates because, anyway, we were paying something like 18, 19%. Money worries are dreadful. So, yes. So I partly...
And you still think now, as I say, extremely successful, very energetic, well paid, you still think that might come crashing to a halt, do you think?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, a good old... Well, I hope not, but you do think that. No, I think you... My wife says to me all the time, you don't need to please your parents anymore. You really don't. They were happy enough, Charles. Just slow down. But we are what our childhoods made us and what our families made us. And A.A. Milne was what his parents made him, what the brother he loved made him, what the brother he didn't love made him. All these things go to making the person. And it's a fascinating story. So I think families are fascinating, childhood is fascinating, being a writer is fascinating. And I envy A.A. Milne two things. I envy him his brilliance as a writer. He really is a beautiful writer of English. Read his novels. The reason the children's books work is they read so well, and you can enjoy them if you're 60 or 6. But also, I envy him because he created a myth. And they're the great people. The guy who created Sir John Falstaff, the guy who created Toad of Toad Hall, the fellow who invented Sherlock Holmes, the man who made Peter Pan, these are the greats in our world. You and I, we're writers. And, you know, A.A. Milne, in those four children's books, he created a world and he created characters, not just one, but in Christopher Robin, Winnie the Pooh, in Piglet, in the relationship between them, in Tigger and Kanga and Roo, in Eeyore. He created types, he created characters, mythical beings that will live, I think, as long as there are people and as long as people can read English or Latin, because as you know, Winnie the Pooh,
Winnie le Pooh
is yes. One of the few great works of literature to have been successfully translated into Latin, and I think I'm right in saying is the best-selling book in Latin in translation, again, in the history of publishing.
Amazing. Giles, we're about to wind up, but you once said to me you wish you'd stayed on as an MP, that here you are, this distinguished writer and broadcaster, but that's what you really love doing, is that right?
Well, I've been let off the hook because I have a daughter who's a Member of Parliament. Now, whether that's to do with her childhood and upbringing, I don't know.
Right, it must be, yeah.
But yes, it is. She's certainly not a Nepo baby in the sense she required no... In fact, I think she said, keep out, Dad. I want to be elected. We don't need you. You've heard me tell that story of going out campaigning, canvassing
for her.
You
wrote about it, but do tell the listeners.
It's quite funny. I got to this door during the last election and I said, I was holding my daughter's leaflet, I said to this very gruff-looking man, Saturday afternoon, he was still wearing his pyjamas. I thought, we're not going to get a vote in this house. I thought, I've got to go through with it. So I handed him the leaflet and I said, I'd be grateful if you would consider voting for my daughter in the forthcoming election. And he said very gruffly, what's she got to offer then? And I said, quite quickly, I was quite impressed with myself. I said, she has got to offer, sir, integrity and intelligence. He looked at me with a beady eye and said, are you sure she's your daughter?
Brilliant.
So, yes, I loved being a Member of Parliament. I really did, because it was interesting. It was fascinating. And I find Members of Parliament fascinating. And I was lucky enough on Rosebud the other day to interview John Major. And he described for me very well why he became a Member of Parliament and the way that maybe it's changed in recent years. I don't know, Mike. I must ask my daughter. There really was, when I was an MP, there was a sense across the House, of all parties, of people going to their constituencies and actually wanting to make life better for the constituents. We're really interested in that. And of bringing communities together, not sitting, you know, not having really strident views and one of having opinions, having ideas of what might help, but actually just wanting to make the world a better place.
And Giles, my last question, you have known the great and the good for over 50 years. You're friends with these titans we talk about, like Joanna Lumley, Judi Dench. Do you consider yourself one of them, or are you what I think the people who, in a way, get on the best in life are what I call insider outsiders? So you know all these people, but do you consider yourself one of them?
No, you're absolutely right. A.A. Milne knew everybody. Prime Minister, P.G. Woodhouse, you name them, he knew them all. Belonged to the Garrick Club, they all belonged there. He was quite interested when, I think it was Kipling or somebody like Rudyard Kipling, came and congratulated him on, you know. So he knew everybody, but he observed them, and that's why he's such a good writer. And I think we writers, Mum. We writers. And we diarists, because you keep a diary too, and I keep a diary, and I've published a couple of volumes of mine. We like to be there. We like to see it. But we're not necessarily part of it. We are observing it. And the odd thing about me is because whenever anybody sees me on television or on Just a Minute or Here I Am Now or the lovely Oldie Lunches or the Oldie of the Year Awards, they see me talking. So they imagine I talk all the time. But in fact, doing what you're doing with the Radio Oldie or doing what I do with my Rosebud podcast is we listen. And I love listening to interesting people.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. And thank you so much to Charles Brandreth for appearing on Radio Oldie.
Oh, I love this wavelength. Radio Oldie is my kind of radio session.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.